I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. You know, there are very few people, although you might be one of them, who have the grit to learn an art or a sport or a craft or some other cultural practice in a locality that is completely foreign. I'm talking about the non-native who shows up in Scotland and learns Highland dancing or the caber toss, or who travels to Japan to study calligraphy. Maybe it's somebody who goes to Australia or India to learn to play the didgeridoo or the sitar, or a non-native like our next guest who could have just studied the city of Venice as a detached anthropologist but really got involved becoming a member of a Venetian rowing club. And that's what I mean by grit. I think very few people would ever do that kind of a thing. Meredith Small is with us. She has a deep acquaintance with Venice and Venetian ways and culture and rowing, apparently, and history. And this is a place with expertise in all things aquatic. And I think the appeal of that is perfectly understandable. She is a professor emerita at Cornell and a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. We have invited her to dip into, note the expression, dip into, Venice as author of the book Inventing the World, Venice and the Transformation of Western Civilization. She's with us now on the line. Meredith Small, welcome to Constant Wonder.
It's nice to be here and nice, of course, to be able to talk about Venice and what a great city it is.
Yeah, but the watery thing, is that like open to anybody who wants to come? Did you kind of have to stick out your neck? I mean, culturally speaking?
You mean to go rowing?
Yeah. Did they welcome you into the club?
Yeah. Well, what happened to me is I had been going to Venice to go to language school. I just started learning Italian as a hobby more than anything. And I had been in Venice for a month or two at a time. And then so I went to language school there. And in language school, I met a young man who was heading for Oxford, a British guy. And he had been living in Venice for a year. And he had joined the Bucentoro Rowing Club. There are 7 rowing clubs in and around Venice. And if you're a tourist, you don't really ever see them. Every once in a while, you'll see somebody rowing down the Grand Canal, and they might have on a particular jersey or a hat. And it kind of looks like maybe they're a member of something, but you often can't tell. And Oliver said to me, I had some friends visiting, and he said, I'll take you all rowing. And I was like, okay. And I had been on lots of boats in Venice, public water taxis, things like that. And we went out one day, and there were 6 of us in a boat and 3 people rowing, and it was miraculous. I just couldn't believe how beautiful it was. And it completely changed the way I saw and thought about Venice, to see it from the water, as a Venetian does. And this whole idea of rowing or being on boats, if you're Venetian, you know how to do this. But for an outsider, to me, it was a great gift. I had a wonderful teacher. Often teaching is in Veneziano, which I don't speak and is difficult for me. But my teacher happened to be an American who had lived in Europe all her adult life and had retired to Venice, and fabulous teacher. So the typical row would be, it's on the south side of Venice, and we're dropped into the water. We sit in a boat, a crane takes the boat, drops it into the Giudecca Canal. And then my teacher Paola rows us across to the more calm part of the lagoon, or we row through Venice and over to Murano. And one of the fun things is you row for a couple of hours and it's stand up facing forward. So it's, for me, it's very difficult. If you do it right, it is perfection. If you have 2 people who are rowing a boat and they are in sync, it just glides across the top of the water. But we always stop at a cafe, a bar, and we get out halfway through and we have an appetizer and we have Prosecco or we have a picnic. And then we get back in the boat and we row back home. It's just a fabulous way to spend the afternoon. And I recommend it to anybody who goes to Venice. If you contact one of the rowing clubs, such as the Bucentoro, they have a website and they'll take you out. You pay for a lesson or you pay for a ride. And I think it's one of the things that a tourist can do that will absolutely change their visit to Venice.
Yeah. Now, I'm fixated for some reason on this technique of standing upright. Are all 6 or just a couple of at a time handling the oars?
Well, it depends on the boat. There's a boat called Carolina, and that's six people rowing, and they're all rowing at the same time. So if you imagine like a scull that we're used to, where there is the person calling out, well, there's sort of a person like that, but they don't have to say anything. I once saw a race of Carolina, and there were about 20 of these boats. And to watch them go is miraculous. You have six people standing up, rowing in a perfect rhythm. They're doing it together. And that's the whole key, is that you're in a particular rhythm. And during my lessons, Paola would have me count. So, and in Italian, like uno, due, tre, so that there was a rhythm to what I was doing when I was the person who was leading the rhythm of the boat that we were rowing. I've only rowed with a total of three people in a boat. There were three of us. I've never done one of the six people ones. I'm sort of scared to. I'm afraid that I might mess it up somehow.
Well, I'm thinking the experience might be like a very large paddleboard, because it's on the paddleboards. People are standing up around here. And I can imagine it takes probably balance and back strength and leg strength, just to say nothing of the arms.
It's mostly arms and some leg. You brace a foot against the side inside of the boat, and you have not an oarlock as we know them, but a thing called a forcola. And it's a piece of sculpted wood that the Venetian oar is very, very long. And so you hold it with both hands and you have it in this forcola, and you use that to twist the oar around. But it is not held in place, so it can pop out. And so one of the things my teacher always did was tie the oar to the forcola so it wouldn't go. But keep in mind that the Venetian Lagoon, it's a lagoon, and so it's actually very shallow. And in most places, you can see the bottom. The average depth of the lagoon is 5 feet. So it's not like you're rowing out into the ocean. It's not like that at all. And it tends to be very calm. There can be waves, and there can be from boats going by that can rock you. But the boats are also designed to handle all that. They don't use a rudder. There's no rudder at all. It's really the person in the back of the boat who's just making the boat go right or left.
What was your learning curve like?
I think it was terrible. I think it was very difficult. Whenever I'd be in Venice for a couple of months, and then I'd think, all right, I'm getting this. And then I'd go home, and then I wouldn't go again for 6 months. And I would say to Paola, okay, we have to start from the beginning again. I wish I could live there for a year and go out 3 times a week, and I would totally have it down. And I don't know if it's just me or if it's the system of the boat or whatever. But I think it's one of those things you have to practice to really know how to do well. It is beautiful to watch from the edge of the city when you see people rowing like this. It's smooth. One of the fun stories I have is there were three of us rowing down the Grand Canal, which you can imagine is a pretty amazing thing. And we have our little jerseys on that say the Bucentoro. They're red. And we went under the Rialto Bridge. And of course, all the tourists are taking our picture. But the funny part was, I'm an American. My teacher is an American. And the other person rowing the boat, who is Italian, but spent most of her life in Argentina and has now moved back to Italy. But she lives in Treviso. She doesn't even live in Venice. And I thought, all these people are taking pictures of us, or the public water bus goes by and everyone's taking pictures. I've never seen anything like it. And it's sort of amusing to be the subject of tourism rather than being the tourist.
Yeah. Well, we should just keep that our little secret. We won't tell them who you really are.
Don't tell anybody. Yeah.
Well, this is this rowing business is a good starting point to talk about a place that was founded on a lagoon. And you've already mentioned that expertise with things aquatic is where the city is and who the people are. And I guess that probably goes clear back to the founding.
Absolutely. There are a lot of stories about the founding of Venice as a place where, when Attila the Hun and the Visigoths came to northern Italy and routed out the Romans, that people then went running into the lagoon. But that is just a myth. That isn't the correct story. And the reason we know that is from the archaeology of Venice and of the lagoon. And recently, there was the announcement that they had found the remains of a Roman road that is now covered over in water, but it was through the northern end of the lagoon when the water was down a lot more. And there was a very clear Roman presence all over the lagoon. And people were already building permanent houses in the 400s AD. And they were there before any barbarians. So, and why not? Because the lagoon is so full of resources, fish, birds. You can't really grow crops, but on some of the islands you can. And so what a great place to live. The added value was it was difficult for people who didn't have boats and didn't know how to do that. But they very quickly realized how to build these houses basically on stilts. And most of the islands, there are basically 30 islands in the lagoon. There is evidence of human living from the past there. They've dug up paths, houses, brick and mortar. So we know that people were inhabiting the area of the lagoon for a very, very long time. And then it went through a period where Rome sort of disconnected from Venice and it sort of belonged to Byzantium. And Byzantium paid no attention because this was not close to where they were. And therefore, the people of the Venetian lagoon started their own government. And it was a government of committees, a government made up of people from the various islands. And that history of a government run by committees was, in fact, the government of the Venetian Republic when it was established.
You're already getting into painting a picture of a community that has kind of a founding or beginning sort of ethos about how to relate to each other and how to govern themselves and how to be away from those really big places like Rome or Byzantium, you know, it's out of the way, and you can't call it – well, you could call it a crossroads, I guess, but how the people saw themselves is just as important as where they really came from.
Yeah, and I think the genius of Venice really was that they were able to take what could have been considered a rough ecology or a difficult geographical position and turn it into a successful, economically successful republic. And they did that by realizing they were in a great position to be middlemen. And they started out with salt and trading salt. And they had various salt pans all around the lagoon, but they quickly realized that they would make more money if they charged all the cargo boats coming into Venice, made them all bring salt. And that was basically a tax to land in Venice. And in fact, the Bucentoro Rowing Club is housed in one of the old salt warehouses on the south side of Venice. And so salt began the trading business in Venice. And they were very successful at this, very successful at establishing posts in the town of Tana. They didn't explore around the world. They really just went around the Levant and the Eastern Mediterranean. And so goods that came to various ports on the Eastern Mediterranean, then Venetian boats picked them up and brought them to Venice. And then they had this incredible network for trading up into Europe. They ferried up the rivers, then they got on carts. So very industrious people in terms that they were not agricultural people. They didn't grow things and sell them. They took the goods of other people and sold them. Many economists think that Venice is the birth of capitalism. And I agree with that.
So I kind of grew up with this notion that the mercantile stuff was very important. You have merchants who are trading. So I kind of knew that. But you're adding a layer to this, going back to this idea of committees, that on these islands there are committees running things. The way the people see themselves is that they're kind of all in it together.
Absolutely. One of the chapters in the book is about community. And I looked at the various inventions that Venetians came up with that have to do with governance and making a community. And because the city is so small, it's only 2.5 miles wide, you can walk around Venice in a day without any problem. And it's very compact and always has been. now there are about 50,000 people. There used to be 150,000 people. And so everyone walking around saw everybody else. It also, unlike other cities in Italy at that time, say Ferrara, Milan, etc., those were run by a noble family, the Medici in Florence. They were the power. Well, Venice never had that. It never had any system like that. It was always these committees. It also didn't have inherited noble titles like Milan or Ferrara or Florence. And so the people who had power were merchants, and they had to work with everybody. They had to work with the people who unloaded, downloaded, and uploaded the boats, the people who owned the warehouses, the people who were going to ferry goods up into Europe. And plus these merchants were just walking around town, running into everybody. And so I believe that that fostered this sense of community. And in the end, the central Venetian government, even though the nobles eventually made themselves more important and gave themselves titles and became the ruling power, there was still this interaction among various socioeconomic classes that connected the city and connected the government, so that the government was watching out for all the people, where some of the inventions like the first streetlights or quarantine, which was invented in Venice in 1348, these are all community. They had the first office of public health. The model we have today comes from Venice. So these organizational things I find extremely important. And also the government had a separation of church and state. So the Catholic Church didn't have the heavy hand that it had in other places like Rome and Florence and Milan. There was always an antagonistic relationship between the Pope and Venice, because Venice now had this history of independence and really didn't like anybody to tell them what to do. In fact, my rowing teacher once said to me, "Oh, Venice, everybody thinks they can do whatever they want here." And that attitude has continued through the centuries. And Venice was and still is the longest standing republic in the world. And when John Adams was looking for a model for the American Constitution, he actually studied different cities and he wrote about Venice. And I've read what he wrote, and it's absolutely accurate. And he said to Thomas Jefferson, "Separation of church and state. Venice has that. We should do that. And that's why we have it here in America." So you see this caring about how the government operated. You see it in Venice the whole time.
We're going to take a short break, but I want to come back to something you just said a moment ago, that you kind of drew a connection between quarantine and streetlights as you were talking about the well-being of the general public and the concern that the government had for the citizenry, generally speaking. We're going to talk about streetlights and quarantine after this short break here on Constant Wonder. We're going to continue our conversation with Meredith Small. She's author of Inventing the World, Venice and the Transformation of Western Civilization. Stay with us for more Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It is quite a thesis to say that the modern world may have been invented in a place like Venice. Here's the title of the book we're talking about, Inventing the World, Venice and the Transformation of Western Civilization. The author, Meredith Small, is with us. She's deeply acquainted with Venice. Meredith Small, we were just talking a little bit about, you mentioned quarantine, and then you mentioned streetlights. That's kind of a funny thing to talk about side by side in terms of the public well-being, but streetlights?
Yeah, it's one of the things that comes from the outgrowth of a government that really cares about its people and is trying to make them safe. And there was a period where there were some, I don't remember if there were murders or whatever, and the Venetian government said, "Now we're going to have streetlights." And of course, there was no electricity. So these were they were candles, basically. And people walked around holding one of these streetlights as well. So it was the place that had streetlights. And the Magistrato di Sanità, which is the public health office, was in charge of things like garbage. So the garbage was taken away, dead bodies during the plague. They were in charge of taking care of that. And they were in charge of quarantine and quarantining ships and people. And I'm talking about in the 14th century, Venice was already doing this, and that the model we have of healthcare here is from them. The Magistrato also was in charge of clean water and making sure that every neighborhood had clean water. So you see the echoes in modern times today, the same sort of issues. We don't throw our garbage in the street. Somebody picks it up. And that was happening in Venice way back then.
And you even describe how child labor was an issue that these committees addressed.
That's right. The first child labor laws came from Venice. And twice, as a matter of fact, they made them even more strict. There were also these guilds, you might call them, or they're called confraternities in Venice, which were not the rich nobles, the merchants, but the other people. And these guilds also did community work. When you go to Venice and you go to some of these beautiful buildings that have paintings in them, they were confraternities. So these guilds were also in charge of things like burying the dead, supporting the poor. There were houses that for nobles who ran out of money, there were houses for them to live in. And everybody was, there was a safety net, I guess is the right word, for various things that is very unusual in Europe of the time.
I want to just zero in on that description of unusual. Why do you suppose a community would have gone down this road of having a solidarity amongst themselves in committees working for the general public's well-being, while at the very same time you go up north and you got a feudal society with some principality, dukes and kings, and running the show?
Yeah. Yeah, and that, of course, is the big question about my book. Yeah, I have a list now. I think it's about over 220 inventions that happened there. And why is that? Why this tiny place? I mean, you would expect that maybe of Paris or London or New York or whatever, but why this place? And my hypothesis is that it's a mixture of history and geography because it was such a small place. And the housing is so built up. If you walk through today, there's no use even using a map. I mean, everything, it's just a labyrinth. And because everybody knew each other, I say it was like a beehive. And then everybody was working together. And basically, they were working on one thing, which is international trade. Yes, other businesses came there, but the basis of the economy was international trade, and almost everybody was involved in it at some level. So there was a unifying feature in this tiny geographic space that was kind of separated off from the rest of Italy. And I have Italian friends who have gone to Venice recently and said, it's nothing like Italy. It's just totally different. And I have friends who say to me, you're an anthropologist, why aren't you going to someplace more exotic? And I just say, it's a very weird place. When you stay there for a long time, these layers come up of what life is really like for Venetians. And I also see there such a loyal pride in Venice. I cannot tell you how many conversations have started with Venetians where they begin with sono veneziano, I am Venetian, and then they say something. And that pride seems to stick with them, and that identity sticks with them when they move somewhere else. And the government, the Republic of Venice, before its fall in the 18th century, you know, it fostered that kind of identity with art, with ceremonies. All these things combined together made a unified community that shared an identity of being Venetian, and it is still there. These are the people who have just stopped the cruise ships from coming into Venice. It is the same people. They are Venetian. It's grassroots. They protested over and over and over, and they won. And it's happening right now about the future of Venice, and there's a move to transform the city into a place for sustainability education. And it's happening. They're actually doing it. So I think these Venetians, the same thing is going on as I write about in my book, the invention, the motivation, and the identity. It's all still there.
I want to talk a little bit more about the arts and education in just a moment here, but I just have to comment here. You know, the idea that they're working in solidarity, in concert with each other, that metaphor of the rowing of the boat and the harmonized strokes, yeah, that fits very well with the whole public temperament.
It does. And it also, if you spend more than 2 days in Venice and really just sit down in a campo and just watch, what you see, what I tell friends that are going there, if you see two people just standing there talking, they're Venetian. If you go into a bar and a couple of people are clustered and drinking their coffee, they're Venetian. They're not tourists. And they're running their lives. If you see people with, you know, books and everything, they're on their way to school, they're on their way to work, and they just continue their lives. But I would also say, well, here's the story. I had three young women visiting me, friends of my daughter, and they had come to Venice. They were going around Europe, and we left the apartment in the morning. I was living near Rialto Market, and I took them down a tiny little alley. We came up on the top of a bridge close to Rialto Market, and I turned to them and I said, "Don't say anything, just listen." And they did for a while. And then I said, "What did you hear?" And they said, "People talking." And I said, "That's the sound of Venice. People talking and the church bells. That is the sound. When you walk around Venice, you always hear people talking." And so you have a society with no cars. And that's the biggest thing. People are walking, they might be on boats, but mostly they're walking and they're talking to each other. And I think that's the key to community life in Venice back then, historically, and also today.
Fold in the strand of education and the history of the universities in the area, because there seems to be some kind of not just a compatibility between higher education and these mercantile interests, but some kind of reason for them being side by side.
Yeah, it historically, well, I should say now, Venice is actually a college town. There are three universities there, probably the best known is Ca' Foscari, which is the University of Venice, a renowned university. And they also have a deep association historically with the University of Padua. And Padua is about a 30-minute train ride from Venice. And historically, Padua was the big university, especially for all the medical inventions that I write about. But Venice didn't, the government did not want all those academics in Venice. They wanted to separate the economic part from the academic part. And so Padua was the academic part. That's where Galileo was when he invented the telescope. It's where the thermometer was invented, the heart monitor, all these things were invented there. But today, there, these three universities are very active. And if you go to on the west side of the Grand Canal to Campo Santa Margherita, which is close to the university, you will see graduations. You'll see people with particular outfits on and they've just graduated from college. And you see, quote unquote, the young people all around. And there are also people who come from overseas to learn Italian, and they might go to Ca' Foscari. There's also a University of Design and Art, which has already turned towards sustainability. So these traditions of being educated and well-read, they're very clear in Venice. There are bookstores everywhere. The bookstores at the museums are fabulous. And there is an intellectual life, all the concerts, all the art shows. They have a Biennale of art, architecture, literature, dance. It just goes on and on. So they are fostering that at the moment in Venice.
And books in the history of Venice, crucial, absolutely crucial.
Absolutely crucial. It's one of my favorite chapters in the book about the written word. And I'll just touch on some of them. There was a very famous printer at the time named Aldus Manutius. He invented the paperback book. with a typographer. They invented italics. He invented punctuation, because before the printed word, manuscripts didn't have punctuation because they were meant to be read out loud. But when you read something, you realize you need punctuation. So he invented the comma, the colon, the semicolon. I mean, it's sort of remarkable. Obviously, Venetians did not invent the printing press, but when it came to Venice, it attracted, at one point, there were over 200 printing presses in Venice, publishing houses. And in fact, when they began publishing like this, instead of a rich person commissioning one book, they began to make many books, and they invented the publishing house, which my publisher was very pleased to learn about. Oh, this happened there. So the stream of these accomplishments in the printed word is pretty amazing. They also had a fabulous network, because of their international trade, of distributing those books up into Europe. And they had agents at these various cities outside of Venice who they would then ask, what do consumers want to read? And then they would make those books. So Venice had a literate population, it had rich people, so it could support the publishing house, and it had this incredible network for distribution. It also had access to paper, because it owned land on the mainland, and they would port the trees down and turn them into paper in Venice. So it pretty much had everything that it needed to do that.
Do you mind if I go back to education? Because I want to introduce a name, sure. This woman named Piscopia.
Yes, the first woman to ever get a PhD in the world. It's Piscopia, which is perfectly fine. She was the daughter of a Venetian noble. And of course, women weren't supposed to go to school. But in Venice, women had more rights. They owned businesses. They owned glass furnaces. They wrote poetry. They wrote books. They were editors. They owned publishing houses. And when they got married, their dowry belonged to them. It wasn't given to their husband. So it's not that life was perfect, but they had more rights. So Elena Piscopia wanted to go to university. And of course, she wasn't allowed to, but somebody got her into Padua. She was able to go, but she mostly did her work. Today, we would call it, like Zooming, in the sense that she had to study at home. She wasn't allowed to sit in the classroom with everybody. And she tried to get a doctorate. I think it was in philosophy at first, but they wouldn't allow her because women were not allowed to study religion. So she got her doctorate in something else. And there is a statue of her. If anybody goes to Padua, the tour is fabulous. And you see a statue of her. And the gift shop's always great, where I bought my mug that says in Italian, it's like a graphic of her. And it says, I was the first of all my friends to get a PhD.
Mm. Now, the thesis underlying all of this, in my mind, is that there's lots of great stuff in the world at large that are kind of forward-looking, and it has to do with the way the world ought to be, and it's more fair for everybody, but the Venetians got there first.
I would say that's true. And I would say, what is the big surprise for somebody reading this book, and certainly me, discovering all these inventions, putting them together, and making sure that they were all true. As an academic, I looked up references for all of them, so I made sure they were true, is that the surprise to me was how much that was invented in Venice so long ago is how we organize our world today. And it has to do with things like quarantine, public health, but also with things like going to the doctor. They were the first to send their medical students to actually touch patients. They were the first to write things down. The medical chart was invented there. All these things, metabolism was first understood there. And so the traditions that we have in medicine were invented there. And that was a big surprise to me. And then the economic part about money. They were the first to have an international stable currency. They invented government bonds. And so this is how we run our lives now. And who knew it was invented by this tiny city so very long ago.
So before I say goodbye, Meredith Small, I'm going to make a statement here, and you help me out with this. And this is generalized, I realize. But it just seems to me that when we talk about inventions, you say the word invention, somebody immediately thinks contraption, something mechanical, mm-hmm. a device. And it sounds to me like the inventions that you get really excited about, yeah, there's the italics. That's a cool invention. That's a thing. It's a piece of typography, right? A little die or whatever they call it. But the inventions that may have changed the world have to do with kind of the mode of social interaction, the modes of governance, the regulation of our lives. You're kind of talking about behaviors and habits.
That's right. And or societal changes that make a community what it is and makes a government what it is. And you hear me, you hear it in my voice that I have great admiration for how they did this and how they continue to do it today. And I have to say, when I spend time in Venice, I'm actually happier because I get up in the morning, I walk down the street, people say hello in Italian, and I go to my local cafe three times a day, you know, for coffee, for a spritz, for snacks, and people get to know you. And I come back to Philadelphia, where I live, which is a very friendly American city, but it's much more lonely here because not only because of the virus, but also just it's more separated and spread out. Whereas in Venice, I always see something new. I see the same people over again and begin to say hello to them. If I put my garbage out, somebody opens their shutters and says, "You're putting it out on the wrong day, you know, put it back in." And I miss that when I'm back here. I suppose at some level you could think it's an old fashioned community, but in fact, there are many places in the world that have community life like this that I think we're out of touch with, mostly because of cars and going everywhere in a car. And we have lost touch with connections with other people. That's my opinion in that sense. And I just find it much more fun over there. And riding around in a boat is a lot more fun than driving a car.
Well, I did say we were going to dip into Venetian ways, and we've just had a small taste of what you have to offer. But it's been a pleasure to visit with you. Meredith Small, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so very welcome.
Meredith Small's book is titled Inventing the World, Venice and the Transformation of Western Civilization. So now, navigate your way out of those Venetian canals, hop in a car on the A13 highway, I believe it is, head south for about 3.5 hours. If you do that, you're going to come to a historic rival of Venice, a sister city, the city of Florence. Florence, celebrated just like Venice in history and in culture. Next on Constant Wonder, we're going to go to Florence and back in time to visit with a man who rose from abject poverty to world fame. How did he do it? Well, he was making and selling books the hard way before the printing press was invented. Great story. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Welcome to Florence, Italy, the year 1433. A young man named Vespasiano de Bisticci has just been hired as an apprentice in the bookmaking trade. How does he start? Well, he learns to carve bindings, to assemble hand-copied and lavishly illustrated manuscripts into books. And after he has mastered all the ins and outs of this exquisite artistry, becomes quite a business for him. He ends up selling books to popes and kings, and before long he is a celebrity and an important intellectual in his society. He becomes known as the king of the world's booksellers. Everything's just hunky-dory, however you say that in Italian, and then the printing press comes down from Germany and it turns his world upside down. It's a great story, and I learned it from Ross King, author of The Bookseller of Florence, The Story of the Manuscripts That Illuminated the Renaissance. Here's part of our conversation. We get going here with a very humble origins of this Vespasiano da Bisticci.
He's one of these people who is from rather humble circumstances. He was a fatherless 11-year-old boy when he went to work. One of the things we have to recognize about Florence is they had what we would describe today as child labor. He started work at 11 in a bookshop. And it's a bit of an open question or a bit of a mystery, really, why he ended up in the bookshop, because of the fact that his father, who died in 1426, Vespasiano was born in 1422, so he was only four when his father perished. We don't know why his father was in the wool trade, and Vespasiano, it would have made sense for him to go work for a wool merchant or someone his father might have known. But instead, he went to work for a bookseller. And it may well be that someone recognized this little boy is extremely bright and loves books, and therefore he can maybe be trained up to do something in the book trade. But I think no one at that point in 1434, when he went to work, would have recognized the sort of grandeur, the heights that he would have reached over the next few decades, as he became known as the king of the world's booksellers. So he was a wheeler and dealer, and he was really the greatest manuscript dealer and manuscript producer in Europe over the course of the 1400s, certainly one of the greatest in history because of the fact that he produced many thousands of manuscripts over the course of his long career, and many, many thousands of others would have passed through his hands as he sold them to both the crowned and the laureled heads of Europe, both very wealthy people who wanted to put together great collections, but also to scholars who wanted to be able to have copies of the books that Vespasiano was producing.
Now, we say that Vespasiano was producing these books. We're so used to a division of labor and specialization. After Henry Ford, we think about the person in charge, but all the laborers doing the grunt work. How would you describe Vespasiano's role in all of this? Was he just the overseer of this? Did he know how to make a book himself? Did he transcribe things the way Poggio did?
He certainly knew how to make a book, but he did not have great handwriting. There were a couple of samples of his writing, and I don't think he ever could have cut it as a scribe. But we have to think of what... it's maybe a good thing to say he was an overseer or supervisor. Another way of thinking about him is he's a combination of bookseller and publisher. He's someone who is publishing books, even though he's publishing them singly, producing these manuscripts. But we have to think of what it was like if you wanted a book back in those times. So if you would go into his bookshop, say in 1440, and say, I want a copy of this Quintilian I've been hearing about. I know how Poggio found a copy of it back in 1416, and I'd love to have a copy and be able to read it. And do you have one? And it might well have been the case that Vespasiano had one in his shop, in which case he would sell it to you. And it probably would have cost, a book like that would have cost probably around 20 ducats or 20 florins. Florin and ducats, virtually the same value gold coin. To put that into context, the wages of a carpenter in Florence would have been 40 or 50 ducats per year. So a single book, a single work of classic Roman literature would have been 6 months' wages. So as you were pointing out, it was merely the elite in society who were able to purchase books. So if Vespasiano did not have a copy of Quintilian, what he would do is tell you, I don't have it, but I will make one for you. And that's when he would go to work as the manuscript producer, because what he would do would be to get a copy of Quintilian, what's called the exemplar. And this is something he excelled at. He would know, for example, that Cosimo de' Medici had a copy of it because he worked on Cosimo de' Medici's library, or he would know that the Benedictine monastery across the street had a certain manuscript, and he could always find one that he would then hire a scribe or scribes to copy. He had access to all of these collections. He could tap a lot of people and say, look, I need to borrow your copy of Ptolemy or your copy of Aristotle for a month or 6 weeks or something like that to get a copy made. And so that's what he would do. He would hire a scribe. He would get all of the parchment. He would give it to the scribe. He would give the exemplar, the copy text, to the scribe and say, here it is, copy it out. And he had around 40 or 50 scribes who worked with and for him at various points in his career. So he could juggle a lot of balls. He had a lot of balls up in the air. as he was doing very large libraries of hundreds and hundreds of copies for people like the Duke of Urbino or people like the Lord of Pizarro, that all of whom wanted hundreds of books to burnish their reputations as great men of learning. And so having then got his copy of the manuscript back from the scribe, he would then give it to someone else, the illuminator, and the illuminator would then take it and decorate it, give flourishes, paint in the capital letters, maybe do some decorations, put in a coat of arms, something like that. And so we would have, at the end of maybe 6 weeks, 12 weeks perhaps, some works took even longer, some might take as long as 6 months to produce, he would have the book for you, and you would then hand over the price of it, probably the most expensive one that he produced. He produced a set of the City of God of St. Augustine, which cost, it was a 10-volume edition, so it was a massive set of work, but it was 500 florins, 500 ducats that it cost, which is, you could buy several houses in Florence for that sort of outlay of cash. And so this is the way he operated. He was, a wheeler and dealer and a mover and a shaker who seemed to know everyone. He was on personal terms with Pope Nicholas V, with three generations of the kings of Naples, with three generations of the Medici, with all of the sort of crowned heads of Europe, with people in Hungary, with people in England. So he was extremely well connected, both in terms of the patrons or the clients that he had, as well as in terms of where books were. I sometimes wonder if he had a kind of photographic memory, because he seemed to know where everything was, where every copy of every book was. And so he could find it and then have it copied and multiplied. I think that was one of the crucial things that he did, was he multiplied wisdom on a modest scale compared to the printing press, of course, but nevertheless, he was diffusing this knowledge all across Europe.
Well, at the peak of his career, Vespasiano catches wind of developments way up north in a city called Mainz in Germany and a fellow named Gutenberg. How does that go over with Vespasiano?
Not well. There was a bit of a time lag for him. He didn't have to do anything immediately because, as far as we know, the Gutenberg Bible, the 42-line Bible, of which probably about 180 copies were printed, was seen for the first time, or at least the first eyewitness account we have of it, comes from someone who later becomes Pope. He becomes Pope Pius II. But he is on a mission from the current Pope at that time in 1454. He's going up. Constantinople has fallen to the Ottoman Turks the year before, in 1453. And so this man, Aeneas Silvio Piccolomini, is sent to German lands to convince the German princes to arm themselves and let's all go into battle and free Constantinople. Aeneas goes up there and turns up at Frankfurt, and the fair is on. And he sees what he calls a miraculous man at the fair with Bibles, which look like they're copied out by a scribe. But as he says, they're not. And this miraculous man has made some 180 of them. And so it's 1454, almost the middle of the century, the middle of the 1450s, that Gutenberg has perfected it and brought it to a very, very high level of sophistication. But the first printing press in Italy doesn't open for another 10 years. It opens, it was Germans who brought it there in 1464 in Subiaco at a monastery outside of Rome. And a year or two later, it moved into Rome. But really by the late 1460s, there were just a handful of printers south of the Alps in Italy, all of them Germans who'd come. They realized that the greatest market for books was in Italy, because the Italians for the previous 200 years had been the greatest producers and consumers of manuscript. They were the Italians were the people of the book at this time, and the Germans quickly realized there's money to be made if we cross the Alps with our printing presses and set up. And so that's what began happening in the late 1460s, early 1470s. And so Vespasiano had some breathing space, and not until 1476 did anyone begin operating a printing press with any success in Florence. And so that's two decades after Gutenberg produced his Bible, and almost a decade after Gutenberg's death in 1468. And when it comes to town, Vespasiano ignores it. He really disdains it. He says that the printing press, a book from a printing press, would be ashamed to share company with one of his books. And that may well have been true, because his books were deluxe items made on parchment with talented scribes and the best illuminators. And a lot of books that you would buy at that time were somewhat haphazardly produced, and the production values maybe were not all that good. The attention to detail was lacking. Of course, there were some very beautiful books produced at this time, but a lot of them maybe were a kind of ephemera that Vespasiano had absolutely no truck with. And so he ignored it until gradually he was swept away by it. The printing press that began in Florence in 1476 was at a convent, the convent of San Jacopo de Ripoli, and it was operated by nuns. Nuns worked as compositors, as typesetters for it. And so Vespasiano ultimately was put out of business. He closed the doors of his shop and retired to the country in 1480, somewhat embittered by what he saw happening. He didn't just blame the printing press. He blamed the times. He said that there were no great princes left like Cosimo de' Medici or like Federigo da Montefeltro, the Duke of Urbino, who had commissioned so much work from him, what Vespasiano called the greatest library since antiquity. All of this world, this bookish world of manuscripts and libraries, princely libraries, was disappearing at that time. And what was taking its place was the world of the common reader. And Vespasiano did not really cater to that. His books were simply too expensive to produce. The printing price reduced the price of a book by 80%. A printed book cost a fifth of the price of what one of Vespasiano's manuscripts cost. So obviously it brought a huge group of new readers into the marketplace. And San Jacopo de Ripoli, with its book, we have the account books of them, and the account books show that a lot of artisans in Florence, shoemakers and wool workers, dyers, people like this were buying the books, which testifies to the high level of literacy on their part, and also the fact that the books were cheap enough that they could afford to dispose of some of their income on a book. And Vespasiano, that was simply a world that he could not inhabit any longer. And so, as I say, he closed up his shop in 1480 and retired to the country and began writing a book of his own, a number of books of his own. He decided, if I can't publish, I'll become a writer myself.
Ross King, author of The Bookseller of Florence. If you needed a life coach to bring you out of your shell, could it ever be an animal?
I didn't like to talk, and I was hiding away. And the fox was so outgoing, he went out of his way to make a friend with a person. I think he knew it's not a great idea to live by yourself.
Catherine Raven with us tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.